This is the Walking Home from the ICU podcast. I'm Kaylee Dayton, a nurse practitioner and ICU consultant. I help teams create awake and walking ICUs through evidence-based sedation and mobility practices. By hearing from survivors, clinicians, and researchers, we'll explore how to give ICU patients the best chance to walk out of the ICU and go home to survive and thrive. Welcome to the ICU Revolution. Hello and welcome back. On one of the videos or pictures posted on Instagram of a patient walking on the ventilator, someone said, quote, "Yep, this is why I work night shift. I'm not doing that stuff," unquote. To which I couldn't resist responding, "The awake and walking ICU team walks almost all patients every night shift around 9 p.m. without any physical therapy present. That is how they ensure a, quote, quiet night." Nurse researcher Peter Nidal recently published powerful information that validates this important practice. If you're interested in current research and are on Twitter, be sure to follow Peter. He joins us now from Germany. Peter, thank you so much for coming on the show with us. Can you introduce yourself?
Yes, Kaylee, thank you. I'm Peter Nidal from north of Germany. I'm a nurse and nursing researcher. I'm working now since 30 years in the intensive care unit here at our university hospital. Well, right now I'm working part-time in the ICU. We say 25%, and that's every second weekend. and the rest of the working time, I'm working as a nursing researcher, doing projects, quality improvement, research, and things like that. And I'm working as a nurse in all shifts. And in Germany, we've got three different shifts, morning, afternoon, and night shift. Actually, I prefer afternoon or night shift. And during our night shift, we take care usually for two patients. One nurse takes care for two patients. And it's a good kind of working, I have to say. But sometimes patients cannot sleep in the night. A lot of German people have sleep disturbances, and when they are in the ICU, it does not become better. Uh-huh. It's even worse. And what I noticed also 20 years ago is when patients become a little bit restless, it's a good idea to make some activities with them, especially in the night or in the late evening. And because then their agitation can be guided into mobility, for example. And it's a good thing to put them on the edge of bed or place them in a chair, watching TV, I don't know, or have a talk. Or what I really love is to offer them a warm foot bath. Just taking a bowl with warm water, put feet in it. It's an old German receipt to fall asleep. Or offer them warm milk with honey. You know this? If the kids cannot sleep?
Oh, it's like, you know, in a couple of generations back, that's what we used to do.
Yes, we still use it here in Germany. And patients know this and like it, of course. Uh-huh. And then you can offer this, and they have something to do, watching TV, drinking a warm milk and things like that. And after, I don't know, half an hour, you place them back into the bed, and most times they fell asleep or have a kind of better sleep than compared to the situation before. So we have a long experience in mobilization of patients in the night. Of course, not always. It depends on the nurse on the bedside. It depends on the physician who is on duty. A lot of nurses and physicians say, well, give them a little bit propofol, midazolam, lorazepam, or whatever. Yeah? But things are changing. And during the last 10 years, I think we have a better quality of promoting natural sleep. So you put down the lights, you are not so loud, you are more silent. Uh-huh. And we are more avoiding sleep medications. And I think it's an interesting development in our sleep culture at all. And then some years ago, I saw a lecture on a conference where a colleague posted one picture of a patient who was mobilized at 11 o'clock in the evening and into a chair, delirious and so on. And after half an hour, he was placed back into the bed and slept the whole night. And I thought, this is perfect. This is the next goal we have to achieve. And so then I started to talk with my colleagues. Also 10 years ago, I founded the German Network for Early Mobilization, and we made a lot of projects and had a good cooperation across Germany, I can say. And so I developed the idea of, let's make a study about early mobilization in the evening. And then our German Society of Critical Care Medicine offered a prize, a research award. There I submitted a proposal and we won 10,000 euro, what is a lot of money for us. And this was the base for developing the project, because my idea was that we have a mobility team consisting of nurses and physiotherapists who came in the evening again. And every nurse or therapist will get 100 euro per evening. And so we spent the money for the mobility team. And we collected three ICUs in my hospital, one in Mannheim, it's in middle Germany, and one in Birmingham, because David McWilliams also joined our project. And then we started in June, of course, because in Germany in June, we've got when the sun goes down, it's called dawn. Uh-huh. That's from Dusk Till Dawn, the famous movie. then the dusk is around about 10:30 here in Germany. So this would be the best time frame for conducting this study. And then we started, made a plan and so on, wrote a proposal, ethic approval, all the things. And we started our study. And very interesting was we limited the study for 2 weeks because we had more money. And the plan is to make a randomized trial to recruit patients out from mixed adult ICUs. And I'm working on a mixed ICU with medical, surgical, trauma patients, neurosurgical patients, also all different kinds of patients, and mobilize them in the evening between 9 and 11 o'clock in the evening for three evenings in a row, consecutive mobilization. Yes. And it worked. It was a lot of fun. The physiotherapists in Germany are working from 8 till 4 o'clock roundabout. And it was very interesting for them to come back in the evening and to mobilize patients, because they said it's more calm working. You can more concentrate on one single patient, and makes a lot of fun to work together with the nurses and so on, and walk around on the ICUs, and they really like it. I had an interview with a physiotherapist from Brazil afterwards, and they have 24 hours shifts, and this is amazing. They have a law. They have a law in Brazil that there should be a physiotherapist 24 hours, 7 days a week. Not all ICUs in Brazil have this, but they said around about half of ICUs have 24 hours coverage with physiotherapists. And this is amazing. They also mobilize patients in the evening. Then they have night sleep for the patients from 11 till 5 o'clock, roundabout 6 hours, which is fine. and then they continue working and so on. So it's well established. It's cost saving, reduces pneumonia, reduces length of stay, days on mechanically ventilation, and so on. So there are amazing studies from Brazil about physiotherapy.
That's why they have so many pictures and videos of patients walking on ventilators, so much research coming out from there.
Yeah.
I just keep noticing Brazil is rocking it.
Yes, of course. So you can make some podcasts from the guys from Brazil.
I need to.
Yes. So we started our trial, and actually I have to look on my data, but we could collect around about, we had 185 patients present in the ICU, and we could recruit 28%, which were 53 patients. And actually, we mobilized 25% of the patients, which were 26 in the intervention group and 20 in the control group. So one quarter of ICU, of all ICU patients, could be mobilized in the evening, which is a good number, of course. A lot of patients were excluded because they were not present in the following night. They had only a short stay, of course, after an operation, just waiting for them to wake up, extubation, and then discharge on the ward, for example. Some patients required deeper sedation because of brain damage, big operations, RDS, for example, and proning and so on. And some were not accessible for delirium because they had disturbances in their consciousness. They were not accessible, and we excluded them.
You mean could not... if you mobilize patients in the evening, if that prevented delirium, so you couldn't start with delirium?
Yes, of course. They had a pre-existing delirium, and then we could also not prevent them. Mm-hmm. So we got included 25% roundabout, and we wanted to mobilize them on three evenings in a row. And that led to 72 possible locations of mobilization. Actually, some patients declined mobilization in the evening because they felt too tired when we came in at 9 o'clock. One patient had pain, severe pain, and they get pyrethramite. It's a painkiller, but it was not enough, and he also declined, and he didn't want to mobilize. Or they had further investigations, CT, MRT, or re-operations, things like that. Happens always.
Yeah, I see you.
Yes, that's life. But the rest of the patients could be mobilized on the edge of bed, sitting in a chair, or some patients even could stand, walk on spot, or walk a little bit in the ICU, of course.
If you've been listening to this podcast, you're likely convinced that sedation and mobility practices in the ICU need to change. The ICU community is facing incredible difficulty with the trauma from the pandemic, staffing crisis, and burnout. We cannot afford to continue practices that result in poor patient outcomes, more time in the ICU, higher healthcare costs, and greater workload for the ICU team. Yet the prospect of changing decades of beliefs, practices, and culture across all disciplines of the ICU is a daunting task. How does this transformation start? It can begin with a consultation with me to discuss your team's current practices, barriers, and to formulate a plan to help your ICU become an awake and walking ICU. I help teams master the ABCDEF bundle through education, consulting, simulation training, and bedside support. Let's work together to move your team into the future of evidence-based ICU care. Click the link in the show notes of this episode to find out more.
Most of these were on ventilators, correct? They were intubated?
A quarter of them were on mechanical ventilation. With an ETT or with a tracheal tube. Uh-huh. Yes, but they were also mobilized. And we had some offerings for the patients, like mouth cleaning, watching TV, warm food bath, and things like that. But most of them wanted to talk, just sit on the edge of bed and have time to talk. even if you're ventilated, then the nurses or physiotherapists were talking, and they were nodding or shaking their heads or writing on paper their thoughts and questions and so on, because it was a calm situation. And patients loved it. During the day, everyone is busy and you have never time for a real talk. And in the evening, it was calm. One patient had one nurse and one physiotherapist for 20 minutes. That was great for them. And the patients really enjoyed this communication, this encounter for them. So it was really good for them. Yeah, mobilization took 20 minutes per patient, roundabout, mostly talks, massage on the back. They liked it, combing hairs, mouth cleaning, so preparing for the evening and this time.
Like anyone normally would. And
yes.
In their night routine.
Yes, of course. Most Germans do this in the evening. Hope so. And so it was... patient-centered, it was usual activities that they all know from home. And I think this is also a kind of reorientating activities. Also for patients who are in delirium or who are pre-delirious, doing something normal for you reorientates yourself.
And it tells your brain that it's nighttime, it's preparing for sleep.
Yes.
So if you're in a room with very little window or light coming in from the windows, there's nothing really showing you what time in the day or night it is.
Yes.
This is a routine that tells your brain it's time to sleep.
Yes. And this is one of our hypotheses, that conducting sleeping rituals induces normal sleep. Also, sitting on the edge of bed and doing some mobilization will make you tired, hopefully. And so it's easier to fall asleep afterwards. Yeah. And maybe it will normalize your brain activity and the neurotransmitters and things like that.
Oh, that makes so much sense. I'm just thinking about how we talk about these concepts like family engagement and cultural sensitivity. I had never thought about asking patients with different cultural backgrounds than me, what do you do in your culture before bed? I never would have thought of that.
Yeah. When we started 20 years ago with rehabilitation on ICU, we also often ask patients, how do you wake up in the morning? How do you stand up? How do you become active? But we never asked, how do you come to rest? How do you fall asleep? Because we wanted to become patients active. But you cannot be active 24 hours each day, so it doesn't make sense. So, but now we are talking more in rhythms, activity followed by rest or sleep. So good questions are, how do you relax after strengthening activities? Do you sleep? Do you hear a great podcast, for example? Do you make relaxing breathing activities, things like that? Or do you just sleep, for example? Yeah, and I think it's a good way to have both, to have activity, but also times of rest. Yeah.
And this is so validating, because in the Awake and Walking ICU, there is a mobility session every evening. So we don't have a physical therapist in the evening, and yet the nurses and the rest of the therapists get everyone up from any time between like 8, 9 o'clock, even till midnight. It depends on if they're awake. If they're still awake, sometimes they'll put in an extra session. If they're really agitated, if they're anxious, if they're restless, if they're sundowning, then get them up again, because that we've seen time and time again that it helps with all of that agitation. And then ultimately they sleep. I think we underestimate how exhausting it is for patients with critical illness to walk or to sit up, depending on where they're at with their function. But you wear them out, and then they finally just collapse and go to sleep without any medications, and it's real sleep. So what did you find in your study?
it was a pilot study, and our primary outcome was feasibility and safety, of course. And what we found is, yes, it's feasible for one quarter of all ICU patients, it's possible to mobilize them in the evening and three consecutive evenings or even more. It was safe, of course. We had some safety issues with exceeding blood pressure, oxygen saturation going down. We had one removal of a line, of an intravenous line, but that's all. And we had to stop mobilization, of course, in 7% of all mobilization. Well, actually, it's fine. It's real life on ICU. And
things are going to happen even if they're in the bed, right?
Yes. Yes. When we conducted our one-day point prevalence study, including more than 760 patients, we found 20% of safety issues happening during mobilization. That's life. So we have a pretty low safety event rate, we can say. What was interesting was that we had less delirium in the intervention group, patients who were mobilized, than in the control group. Well, we had a low number of patients in both groups, 20 patients, but the rate of delirious patients in the intervention group was 27% and in the control group, 50%. This was not significant because we had low numbers at all, but it shows a clear trend to have less delirium in the intervention group. That means it can work, it can have a preventive effect. Mobilization in the evening can have a preventive effect in general ICU patients. We found also a lower duration of existing delirium. Patients in the intervention group, delirious patients in the intervention group, had 1.5 days in delirium, and in the control group, 2 days. That would be a reduction by 25%. But actually, we had this is a pilot study. It was not significant, and we need more confirming trials to confirm these data, of course. So there is a promising signal, I have to say, that mobilization in the evening makes sense in preventing and treating delirium. And this is very exciting for me as a nurse, and maybe for you too. So what I can say that is also that David McWilliams from the United Kingdom wrote an approval for a larger grant, because we want to repeat this study with a larger group of patients. And we calculated that we need 140 patients, 6 weeks, and 30,000 euro to conduct a full trial. And of course, we are planning to repeat this trial in United Kingdom, Switzerland, and of course in Germany. So it will be a multi-center trial. And we hope that we can repeat or maybe even improve our results. What we have to keep in mind, what we planned to analyze, is does delirium help in different, does mobilization help in different types of delirium? You all know this type of hypoactive, hyperactive, and mixed delirium. This is not what we have in mind, but and there are different phenomenons of delirium. Girard published a paper 2 years ago about shock-induced delirium. So delirium may be caused by reduced cerebral perfusion because your blood pressure is low by a shock, for example, mm-hmm. or severe bleeding. But delirium may also be induced by hypoxia, RDS, for example, severe pneumonia, and so on. And then the oxygenation of the brain is also reduced, which may lead to delirium. Or hyponatremia, for example, may lead to delirium. So our idea was to make an analysis, where does mobilization work best in patients with shock delirium, with sedation delirium, with hypoxia delirium, with metabolic delirium. Actually, we had too few patients and we could not analyze this. But of course, I think it's reasonable. If you have a patient who has possible a delirium which is caused by hypoxia, it would make sense to mobilize them, because we know oxygenation is improved during mobilization, and in consequence, the brain oxygenation must also be improved, so maybe preventing or treating delirium.
You make such a good point, and yet that is a misunderstood concept in the ICU, right? If someone's hypoxic, a lot of ICU healthcare workers are going to hesitate to mobilize them. They're going to be afraid to get them up, right? So yes. I just want to point out the irony in what you just said, because it's what you said is true, but it goes against our cultural practices.
So we think,
oh, well, they have really bad pneumonia. They have ARDS, so we can't get them up. And granted, if they completely desaturate and go, you know, extremely hypoxic at 60% with any kind of movement, then we can't move them, right? But otherwise, we can get them up and it improves their perfusion.
Oh, very, very important point is what we also said 10 years ago. In patients who are mechanically ventilated, you have to adapt the settings of the ventilator to the level of mobilization. So this is very important. Usually we set the ventilator settings to lying patients. And patients who are lying in bed have a different metabolism than active patients. So when you start mobilization, maybe you have to increase the pressure support a little bit. Maybe you have to reduce the time when the gas flow comes into the patient so that the patient can have a shorter breathing, an increased breathing. Maybe you have to increase the oxygen delivery a little bit more from, I don't know, 50 to 60% or whatever. So the patient feels fine breathing with pressure support and standing up or even walking. Otherwise, you have an iatrogenic weaning failure, because if the ventilator settings are not adapted to mobilization, the patient will deteriorate, so become worse.
And we, for patients that are not on mechanical ventilation, we apply this concept, right? If they're on 2 liters nasal cannula, then we turn it up to 6 if they need to walk, or yes, with an non rebreather on, and we don't think anything of it. And yet we feel like those settings are permanent, or the only settings they might need if they're laying there on a mechanical ventilator. So I think you make such a good point that we can adjust that, and improves their oxygenation when they get up, and improves the blood flow and the oxygenation to their brain, and it improves their delirium.
Yeah, makes sense.
Absolutely.
Yes, of course. So this is very important during mobilization, but even if you don't adapt the ventilator settings to the mobilization mode, we know by several studies that the lung ventilation is improved when you come up, when you are sitting, when you are standing, and so on. So it may be lead to improved cerebral oxygenation, and this also will improve delirium or prevent from delirium, but not when you have a shock. So when you have a reduced blood volume, reduced mean arterial pressure, and you come up, maybe the blood, the cerebral perfusion is reduced. And for some patients, it's reduced under a critical limit. And then the brain activity becomes worse, and maybe you create delirium. We know from patients after a stroke that too early mobilization is bad for the brain. If you within the first 24 hours after stroke, in severe stroke, mobilization leads to severe neurological problems afterwards. And it increases mortality. After 24 hours, it becomes a little bit better. But what you always should avoid is to place a patient into a chair after a stroke and let them sitting for hours. This is not good for a damaged brain. And I think we can transfer this knowledge to also non-neurological patients. You all know this ICU patients, when you place them into a chair and leave them there for hours, then the patients become tired, falls asleep, sitting in the chair. And when you look at the feet, they become full of edema. Mm-hmm. The complete volume goes down and the feet becomes blue and violet. And, you know, the brain is not really good perfused with oxygen. So maybe that brain perfusion is an important factor we have to consider when we mobilize patients. And I think this will be the next step for research, that we mobilize patients, that we look for possible causes of delirium, and does delirium really improve under mobilization, or does it become better? Yes. Or do we cause even more harm in terms of delirium? And this will be the next steps, I think. And in our large trial with David and others, I hope that we have enough data to make first analyses for this. Yeah.
Oh, this is so exciting. It's so validating to what the Awake and Walking ICU has always done, but you bring up such important considerations that when a patient's not well perfused, it's probably not the time to get them up. And I've always kind of said that if a patient's in septic shock and you're pouring fluid in and you're increasing vasopressors, that's not the time to get them up. There are always exceptions to mobility, right? And it's doseable. So if they're, and you can see how they do, if they're seemingly stable while they're in shock, you know, we're not pouring fluid in, they're kind of settling down on one vasopressor, you can sit them on the side of the bed and see how they do, but take it very gradually and keep assessing the perfusion and take that into consideration as you move forward.
Yes. There are a few studies about mobilization in septic patients, which is amazing. And this was also feasible and safe, but they did not research delirium and brain function, of course. And this would be the next step, of course. Are your kids waking up now?
My baby's looking for me, but my husband has and he's fine.
Oh, great.
So, as a nurse researcher, I see you on Twitter posting study after study after study, and it just reaffirms to me that there's so much research out there. What would you have the ICU community understand, or what would you guide them to be reading and looking into to help change their perspective and their cultures and their ICUs?
What I'm interested in is general early rehab. This can be physical. This can be mental, avoiding PTSD, anxiety, depression, and so on. You can also look for social functioning, integrating the family, and so on. And the best summary is the ABCDEF approach. And when you're looking at the website of the Society of Critical Care Medicine, it's perfect. You find everything you need to change your ICU team. They are doing an amazing job, I have to say, on this website, because you can download educational material, PowerPoints, videos, everything is there. You just have to use it. This is perfect.
That's a great resource. And they also have like work groups or support groups, right? When people are looking at working on projects, and there's a lot of collaboration going on where everyone can give ideas and share what they're doing and what's working.
Yes, yes. But you asked me for favorite literature.
Yeah.
And I'm a great, great fan of Dale Needham from Baltimore. And Dale has a great newsletter. It comes out every month. And he is also listing several new studies and so on. And Dale and I and Cheryl Hickman from the Netherlands, we are collecting all this literature in our literature list. And you can download this literature list on mobilization-network.org under publications. I can send you the link.
And I will put the links on the Medium blog. You guys do incredible literature reviews.
Yeah. Now we've got more than 2,500 titles in this Word file. including links to PubMed and other databases about sedation, delirium, early mobilization, occupational therapy, patient outcome, family integration, teamwork, and so on. So it's a huge list. Also, some PhD students used it for the work because it's really valuable. And every important study is in this list, I think. So I really like it and I recommend it to all who are listening now.
Absolutely. I have people reaching out to me all the time, students, professionals, everyone's asking for the links and literature. And that's why I created the blog. But I think everyone can be very convinced by all the research that's out there.
Yeah.
And yet we vastly underread it and underutilize it.
Of course. Yes. Yes.
Anything else you'd share with the ICU community?
Enjoy and have fun. never give up. Listen to Kaylee's podcasts. They are really amazing. And you have a broad spectrum of the topics. This is great. So I really love it. And never give up.
Absolutely. I think people get really overwhelmed by this prospect of change and yes. feel like they may never see it in their unit. But I really know that it's possible that any unit can be an awake and walking ICU. And I would encourage everyone to follow Peter on Twitter. I'll put a link to your Twitter. You're always posting such great research and insights. And it's exciting that you're a researcher, but you're also actively at the bedside applying these principles, real life experience. You're just a great resource in our community. So thank you so much for enlightening
us.
And keep us posted on your next study.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kelly.
If you want to join in on the conversation, leave a voicemail at 801-784-0472 or reach out to me on Twitter. Schedule a consultation for your ICU, as well as find supportive resources such as the free ebook, case studies, episode citations, and transcripts, please check out the website www.daytonicuconsulting.com.